So with those very quick technical reminders, I think we are ready to officially get started with our session today. So I'll ask our other session moderator, Josie Torres from SCIO, to pull up the presentation materials. And then I'm going to invite your first speaker today to put her on camera. Alexis, I can see you. They can see you. I see the slides. And Alexis, I'll go ahead and let you unmute and I'll turn the floor to you to get started.
All right. Thank you, Jean. Thank you so much. And thanks to everyone who's joined us today. We're really excited about this. I saw in the question and answer, there's, you know, a range of folks, new and old. And I myself am one of the newer people to the program. So I'm right there with you, but I'm really excited to keep learning and keep sharing about this information. So just to introduce myself really briefly, my name is Alexis Vork-Reyes. I've recently come on board as the program manager for EPA Superfund Redevelopment Program. So that's the part of Superfund, the program at EPA that's bringing you this webinar and that brings you a lot of other resources that we'll talk about. And just so thrilled to be part of the program. I'm still learning the ropes, but every day I get inspired of different stories of reuse, and I think you will too. Especially today, as we're celebrating July as National Park and Rec Month. So we have some good recreational focused stories for you this summer. And you know, just the intention of these webinars are really designed to share valuable site reuse information, success stories, and challenges. And that we hope that this information will inspire you to consider reuse on impaired or remediated properties, Superfund or otherwise. There's so much potential out there. And you know, these webinars provide guidance, tools, and lessons learned. And again, as Jean said, you'll be able to access this and share it in the future with folks. So we hope that you'll do that. I'm going to go to the, I'm joined by colleagues kind of offline, Chelsea Sebetich from the Superfund Redevelopment Team at EPA, and also our colleague, Tony Stillman from the Academy of Model Aeronautics. We'll be hearing from him in a bit. Can we go to the next slide, please? Thank you. All right. So just to give you a quick rundown of what we're going to cover today, we are going to talk about how Superfund sites can be well suited for recreational reuse and can provide an array of benefits to the community. We'll kick things off with a brief introduction of the Superfund Redevelopment Program. Then I have four Superfund case studies for you, highlighting how EPA has worked with the local stakeholders and the site owners and to facilitate recreational reuse. And again, one of our partners, Tony Stillman, will be joining us, and he's going to provide kind of a more detailed example of how his organization, we'll call it AMA, Academy of Model Aeronautics, how they have been involved in reusing Superfund sites for their members across the country. And then we'll wrap up with an overview of available tools and resources and jump into question and answer. So let's get started. Next slide, please. Thank you. So again, just an intro to Superfund Development Program. And if you can take your eyes off those puppies in the top left for a second, you'll see actually right next to that, there's a photo of one of the flying sites for Tony's association. So one of the clubs that operates locally, that's what it actually looks like on the ground. And he'll be sharing more about that in a bit. But again, our mission at Superfund Redevelopment Program is to support EPA staff who are really the front line out there in the regions and the site teams, and also the communities and other partners that consider future use opportunities and integrating reuse options into the cleanup process. So you'll hear me say that a couple of times because it's really important. We really encourage reuse considerations to be made all throughout the cleanup process because it really can help inform the design sometimes of remediation and really make things that much easier and focused on addressing some of the community's vision and interests. So there are a number of examples of Superfund site reuse all over the country. These are such a couple of examples that you'll see pictured. But redevelopment of Superfund sites is not easy. These sites pose very unique challenges in terms of protectiveness, stigma, and liability protections. But they also have a lot of potential and allow for a broad spectrum of safe and productive reuse possibilities. We really want to highlight those. And again, EPA does not own the sites or control local land use. even so, we do our best to support the redevelopment process in a number of ways, which we'll talk about. But it's really important part of EPA's mission, and also because it's important to the communities that have been living in Superfund sites and impacted by some of the contamination. And so the good news is, again, is that we have a wide array of tools and resources for local governments, communities, and developers. And we'll get into some of those in a bit. But can I have the next slide, please? Thank you. Well, I wanted to just, before we share the tools at the end, I want to just share with you the benefits of reuse kind of in more concrete terms. So one, sales and, you know, economic development, economic improvement, as you can see from the statistic that we have on the slide. Reuse aids in EPA's goal and our mission, which is protecting human health and the environment. And it does that because it develops long-term stewardship for the site and also can leverage additional benefits for the communities. And those are both really top priorities for us. So, you know, just kind of a factoid here. Did you know that it's estimated that 4.5 acres of greenfield, so undeveloped land, are protected for every acre of brownfield or contaminated remediated lands that are redeveloped? So what we're saying is that there's not a lot of undeveloped land out there in our country anymore. And the more that we can take advantage of existing properties that have been developed, have been used, remediate those, we're also doing our part in conservation over those really important parcels of undeveloped land. And reuse also supports social equity. When community needs are accounted for, providing opportunities to develop strong relationships with the community, as well as encourage equitable development and addressing environmental justice concerns. And finally, again, reuse can lead to economic improvement. So bringing jobs, employment, increased tax revenues, sales generated by businesses at Superfund sites that are being reused totaled over $65 billion in just 1 year, as you'll see there. And so, you know, when you think about return on investment for the $17 billion or so that EPA spent cleaning up these sites, you're getting a good return there. And that's good news for all of us. Next slide, please. So again, the ultimate goal of Superfund is really to return the sites back to productive use. And it's not only part of our job, but it is an important part of our job. But it's often a really fun part and creative and exciting and innovative. And I think the more I learn about different stories around the country, it's really great to be able to meet the needs of communities through this work. So rather than spending millions of dollars cleaning up a site so that it will just sit fenced up and vacant, we get to try to do our shepherd it back to productive use and maximize all the community and EPA benefits. And so the ultimate goal, again, is to return sites back to productive use in a protective manner. So we're not undercutting in any way some of the protections and the cleanup goals and that have been decided on the Superfund cleanup process. And so that's why every one of these projects that you'll hear about, they're really that much more amazing to hear about because they're all done so in a very carefully designed way to make sure that the cleanup and the remedy that was put in place still remains protective while getting benefits back for the community. So it's pretty amazing. So I think with that, we'll go to the next slide. Thank you. Thank you. And again, as I mentioned before, sites can be reused and at any step, reuse and exploring, you know, reuse and redevelopment options at any point in the Superfund cleanup process. There are so many different ways that you can reuse Superfund sites, and there's no one size fits all solution to determining what's most appropriate. That's something that's decided on by all the stakeholders. So some local governments and community members, I saw some of you are newer to Superfund in the chat and may think that a site cannot be reused at all until the cleanup is done. And that's actually not true. So in fact, you know, the earlier that EPA can identify some of the end use and redevelopment options, the better, because there's also opportunities for partial reuse. Superfund sites are divided up into these parcels called operable units. And that's kind of the way that they can tackle some of the cleanup work, but also the redevelopment and reuse work. So just because you think that the entire site is not cleaned up and ready to go, there still may be opportunities. So it's definitely worth looking into along the way. And these are just kind of some of the examples that we wanted to highlight. For example, if you're planning for a parking lot, you can use that as a cap for contamination, or you might have monitoring wells to monitor groundwater that could be located in ways that kind of facilitate better reuse of the property. And so the earlier that people know about that as they're designing the cleanup, those are really important pieces of information that they can keep in mind to not create more work in the future and really facilitate that process. So go to the next slide, please. All right, and with that, I want to dig into some great examples of the recreational reuses on Superfund sites. We have 4 case studies for you. And with all of them, especially for folks that are newer to Superfund, you'll hear a little bit about the Superfund site itself, what the remediation steps included in terms of the cleanup and protectiveness, and then also the recreational reuse and things. They're all a little different, like Superfund sites are. So the things to kind of listen for are, you know, what are some of the partners that are involved? What are the funding mechanisms that were involved? And also keep an ear out for ways that EPA can be of assistance. And we'll circle back after the case studies to talk about that a little bit more. But with that, Josie, maybe we can go to the first case study. Oh, thank you. Which is Chisman. The Chisman Creek Superfund site in Virginia. I live in Maryland, so this is right in my backyard. And we did this one first because, you know, don't quote us on this, but I think this site, kind of one of their claims to fame is being one of the first ones to be redeveloped. So this is a 27-acre site in York County, Virginia. And for a period of about almost 20 years or so, there was a power generating station that used 3 sand and gravel pits on the site to dispose of the ash that was left over from burning fossil fuels. And I mention these details just because this is how every Superfund site is different. There's different kinds of history in terms of contamination, and that all informs the design, which informs the reuse. So these are important things to keep in mind if you have a Superfund site near you that you're interested in. And again, so the leftover ash was deposited in these 3 pits along its property by a creek, Chisman Creek. It's a tributary of the Chesapeake Bay. So for those out of the area, that's a really big deal for us on the eastern shore and all of, you know, the eastern side of the country, in fact. And so I think the earliest kind of detection started where there were some residents that lived near the pits and noticed, you know, something that looked funny in their well water. And so there was some testing done by Virginia Department of Environmental Quality and EPA and discovered that the water contained something called vanadium, which is when it was above the levels that were safe for humans. So they worked together to develop a plan for addressing that contamination. And in 1983, EPA placed Chisman Creek site on the Superfund list because of these levels of trace metals that were above normally what's found in the immediate area. So it's a long process. And then the cleanup started in 1987, and that was through joint kind of supervision under EPA and the Virginia Department of Environmental Quality and Dominion Energy, which used to be called Virginia Power, which was identified as the potentially responsible party. And so there's a lot of kind of collaboration that happens in this. And it included, in terms of some of the cleanup, connecting nearby homes that, you know, were using wells, as those the people that are originally found out, connecting those to the public water supply, then placing a cap and a soil cover over 2 areas of the site. groundwater collection, modification of the stormwater, the surface water drainage pathways, and the monitoring surface water. And at that time in the program's history, what you would probably have expected to see after all that remediation was just an area kind of secured with a fence and barbed wire. But folks in the local government and actually from Dominion Energy at that time wanted to work with EPA to think about, let's do something better with this. And so they had the idea of using it for a recreational park. So you want to go to the next slide? Thank you. And so again, this is an amazing success story. There's so many, as you can see, kind of pictured here, there are so many different uses that are going on at this site. And, you know, of course the folks at the agencies and local governments had some idea, but also was really guided by the input of the community. And they wanted to see the recreational reuse. And that's really important information to share with EPA. And as we'll talk about in a little bit, EPA has tools to help kind of engage communities. We do really deep community engagement, in fact, around Superfund sites. And so we want to know not only what we can do to keep communities safe around Superfunds, but also how can we kind of help fulfill some of their aspirations for their own families as part of having this area in their community. And so the way that that this particular kind of arrangement worked is that, you know, Dominion Energy is, they're always going to be involved. EPA is always involved. The company owns the land and they retain liability. And the county leases the land from the company for a fee equal to the county property tax charges. And so, you know, there's a lot of clever things that can be done kind of between the local governments and site owners to kind of help facilitate reuse and redevelopment in a way that works for all. So just to highlight some of the features of this site, now they includes two lighted softball fields. They have a 28-acre wolf trap park, which has full-size soccer fields, instructional size fields, ponds. It also has a memorial tree grove, which people in the community go to and are able to kind of dedicate trees to their loved ones that have passed on and kind of have that as a site to remember them. This cleanup plan also ensured the preservation of wetlands and became part of a larger water quality improvement effort that led to the reopening of the Chisholm Creek estuary for fishing. So these things can have ripple effects in a good way. And it's all about kind of the communication and understanding the unique aspects of each site. So this is, we put this one first because this is one of the first. And in 2017, EPA presented a State Excellence in Supporting Reuse Award to the Virginia Department of Environmental Quality to recognize a lot of stories. Actually, Virginia is a place that has done a pretty noteworthy job on this kind of work. And so that included this site. So we'll go to the next slide, please. And this is a great one that we wanted to highlight for other reasons, not the least of which is that it's really amazing. I mean, it's just really comprehensive. There's these huge sites and so much is possible, but this is called the Cascade Park Gasification Plant. That was the name of the Superfund site. That's not what they called the park. They called it Cascades Park, and it's a 24-acre park along another stream called the St. Augustine Branch in Tallahassee. And one of the things I think is really cool about this site is it's also has a lot of history. So I think they've done a beautiful job in the redevelopment of kind of bridging the old and the new, and it actually is on the National Register of Historic Places. We'll say a little bit about that in the future, but just kind of going back to this, the more recent history of it's a Superfund site. And so there was a 10-acre gasification plant, and that from 1895 until the mid-1950s, the city of Tallahassee operated a plant there, a gas plant, and turned coal into gas actually to provide light and heat for city residents. And then there was also a landfill that was opened nearby and accepted waste from that plant. But then in 1987, the state of Florida and EPA determined that the site activities and the waste management practices had done lots of damage and contaminated soil, sediment, and groundwater. And so the city, and again, the state agency, Florida Department of Environmental Protection, worked with EPA to clean up the site. And this was a little bit of a different process. This is a non-time critical removal action, but still, again, clean up and has access to all the resources. That's another thing too important. If there's a site near you that's subject to a removal action, some of these tools and resources that we'll talk about later still apply. And the cleanup activities that happened there included removing, hauling out all this contaminated soil, capping any of the residual contamination that was still there, and monitoring groundwater. And, you know, really, really glad they did. And I think that the community was, in fact, because this had been a place that as early as the 70s, folks had wanted to and kind of conceived of it as a park because it had this stream and shallow waterfalls, but it was really unsafe. And so it wasn't until after that remediation process happened that they were able to start construction on a new park, which started in 2010. Using money from the penny sales tax. So if you want to go to the next slide, Josie, we can show folks. Oh, just to point out really quick that the picture on the first slide on the right is a map of all the things that are going on there. And we'll talk a little bit about those here. But as you can see from some of these photos, they really have something for everyone. And again, it's the community developed a reuse plan to manage stormwater, create a public park, preserve local natural resources, and commemorate the site's history. And so in 2008, this was also just the planning efforts, not even the implementation and, you know, the park itself, which was opened in 2014, just the planning efforts were recognized with the Excellent in Site Reuse Award from EPA. But again, the park itself opened in 2014. It includes 2.3 miles of trails, playgrounds, a waterfall, interactive fountains, boulder climbing, beachscape, an outdoor classroom, which looks amazing, and an amphitheater for concerts and community events. And then it's also a really special place for the area's history lovers. It includes a memorial to the Korean War, also a monument for, as I mentioned earlier, which is why it's on the National Register, is there was a historical marker that was used for navigation and selecting Tallahassee as the state capital in the early 1800s. And so there's still the marker that folks that were kind of doing that initial mapping of when Florida became part of the United States, there's still kind of a relic there. And they've done a really beautiful job, if you look online, showing that commemoration. And then also a memorial to an African American community that historically resided at the site. So, and then again, as I mentioned before, also stormwater management system was included to provide flood relief, of course, Florida, during major storm events. So really, really thoughtful design that we wanted to share with you. Let's see, so I can stay on track here. We'll go to the next one, please, which keeps us in the Southeast in South Carolina. And this is, the name of the Superfund site was Lexington County Landfill Area, and it's in Casey, South Carolina. You can see what it looked like, or this looks like it's sometime during the remediation process, but it's a really large site. It's 160 acres, and it was a site home to three landfills that operated there for about 50 years. And so, not surprisingly, EPA and, again, state agency, South Carolina Department of Health and Environmental Control found that those activities led to groundwater contamination. So the site was added to the national priorities list, which is how EPA kind of recognizes Superfund sites, and that was in 1989. And actually thinking about this space as an opportunity for reuse, the county actually agreed to lead and fund the site cleanup. So that's kind of an interesting opportunity too. A lot of times in Superfund, we hear about Superfund led or the potentially, you know, the responsible party leading it or even a state government, but this was a county. I think that speaks to kind of the potential that they saw there. They started the cleanup in kind of the mid-90s and included consolidating and capping waste. So, you know, huge effort after 50 years of landfill, regrading areas, treating the groundwater, and installing a landfill gas collection system, because a lot of that still remains. If you want to go to the next slide, we can show how this area is used today. Not a trace of it. It looks lovely. And these are mostly used. There is a recycling center that's does employ people and provide a valuable service to the community, but it's mostly used for recreation, and namely golf, with a number of different partners. So we have some private companies there that operate driving range and mini golf. And then there's also through cooperation with the county, it's just like we were talking about before, that sometimes this cleanup happens in stages in different parts of the site. So they were able to work with those smaller businesses for them to be able to stay in business while cleanup was happening. And so again, that requires some coordination, but it sure is worth it. And then another partner that we wanted to kind of highlight was the University of South Carolina. That is a Division I golf team. And they use the part of the site to develop an indoor practice facility, and then also their driving range and their short game. So that's where they go. It's near campus. And I just wanted to highlight here, for those that are not familiar with, EPA actually has a program that helps communities kind of engage more with colleges and universities in ways that they can kind of partner for mutual benefit. Students get a lot of learning out of it, and communities can benefit from some of the expertise of the students and faculties and just the manpower there. So there's some really exciting examples of that. I'm happy to answer or refer you to more information on that later, but just thinking about universities as an important group too. Again, this was another award-winning site. Another, just to highlight one more thing that they did was, in addition to the partnerships, which we talked about, they also did a lot exploring green cleanup options. And so that's another way that EPA can kind of advise. So with our final case study is Bunker Hill Mining and Metallurgical Complex in Idaho. So I had to make sure that we get out of the Southeast a little bit, lovely as it is. And as you can see, this is a historic photo of the Bunker Hill lead smelter. And these are massive operations. They are massive sites. And so, this site happens to be in Idaho. It's called the Silver Valley. So it's one of the largest historical mining districts in the world. They actually still continue mining in this area. And silver and lead are among the things that were mined. And, not to surprise anyone, I guess here, there was a lead smelter and a couple of associated mines that were closed in the 80s, but the heavy metals had been left behind, contaminating the countryside. And there was some really important impacts to the area's children in terms of high blood levels, which is, nobody wants to see. And to have happen to these young folks. And so in response, EPA added, it's a 21 square mile area around the smelter to the national priorities list, again, designating it part of the Superfund program in 1983. And there's a lot of cleanup, and I think this is ongoing, and I wanted to include it for you just as food for thought, of that these are these huge sites, and they're complicated and big. And so, but there are still good wins and incremental things, ways to benefit the community along the way. And so some of the steps that have been taken so far are removal of lead contaminated soil from residential and commercial properties and common use areas like parks. There was containment. So, of millions of tons of mine tailings and planting of 2 million trees in the surrounding acres. And fortunately, lead levels in children fell dramatically. And that's really good news. But EPA continues to work with the state of Idaho and Panhandle Health District. And I know there are tribal communities in the vicinity as well to educate, you know, local children about avoiding lead contaminated areas, and also especially in recreational areas. And so, and also along with that, we haven't talked about it yet, but along with Superfund cleanup, there are another tool called institutional controls, which are some of kind of the restrictive covenants that might go around use of a piece of land that's part of Superfund to make sure that that people are protected from additional exposures. And so that's, it's, they work together. It's the physical part of the cleanup, and then also kind of the covenants and the ways that EPA and its partners decide on how the site can be used and what information needs to get out to folks in the area about it to keep them safe. So we can go to the next slide just to show some of the good things that are going on there so far. And again, this is one, since we're focusing on recreation this month, wanted to highlight, you know, some of the playgrounds and ponds, and there's, you know, it's part of a more extensive trail and bike network. There's a mountain resort in the area. And so a lot of this, the city of Kellogg in Idaho is leading this redevelopment effort, and more than 1800 acres of the property have been transferred to the state so far for economic development projects. And among them, you know, again, are these kind of smaller park facilities, but also the Silver Mountain Resort, which is a larger scale project. It includes a neighborhood, condominiums, commercial development, indoor water park, golf course, and ski area. So lot to do. As you see pictured here, this trail runs through the site. And there are other reuses that are, you know, just good to flag for y'all, not just recreational, commercial business, multifamily housing, and wetland habitats. And so this is another way that we kind of wanted to share is that this was one of the sites that benefited from reuse project planning for the site. So this is a resource that we'll talk about towards the end, but that's one of the ways, I think one of the really important ways that EPA Superfund redevelopment program can help communities and all the stakeholders involved in Superfund sites on planning for reuse. We can develop an area-wide reuse plan and assessment for different kinds of uses that people might be interested in. More on that later. But without further ado, I think I should turn it over to our friend Tony. And just wanted to give a brief intro. So Tony Stillman, thanks Tony, I see you, is up from the Academy of Model Aeronautics. So again, it's an association that serves members all over the country that have been interested in kind of model aeronautics, model airplanes. I'm going to say, I'll let Tony say it in the official way, but it's pretty cool. And I didn't know that there was such an extensive network. And we've been kind of collaborating with this organization for some time and just kind of sharing public information about what's available in terms of Superfund sites and connecting them with the folks that are kind of closer to the project on the ground so they can vet opportunities. So this is just a map of just six sites where SRP or EPA is kind of engaged with AMA and their clubs to offer opportunities for flying. And so with that, I'm so happy to introduce Tony Stillman.
Thanks, Alexis. I appreciate that. Yeah, I'm just happy to be here and talk a little bit about the Academy of Model Aeronautics and what we do and how we got engaged with the EPA. The Academy of Model Aeronautics is a membership organization of about 180,000 members, and we fly typical all types of model aircraft, but most folks are flying radio control model airplanes, and these can be anything from small little aircraft that you could hold in your hand that weigh less than an ounce up to large aircraft with 12, 14, 16 foot wingspan weighing up to 100 pounds. But we are based in Muncie, Indiana. We've been around since 1936, And we've been working with the FAA for years, as well as our international organization, the FAI. And we have competition events. We have just recreational activities. And we deal with local governments and federal government as well. We're deeply involved with the FAA right now with the drones that you hear about on the news, and how we can protect our members to continue to fly the way we have over the past since 1936. And so our model airplane clubs are associated through us. We provide these clubs with the ability to purchase site owner insurance for about $2.5 million worth of site owner insurance that they can use to look for flying sites. Most of these clubs are flying on, they're all flying different lands. Some are rural lands and some are in town. You know, they can be a small park in town and flying small models. We have a lot of electric models now that folks fly. They're very quiet, leave minimal impact in the area. And so our mission to talk about model airplanes, to engage folks with model airplanes, has, because of the long amount of time that we've been doing this, and modeling has been around for so many years, it's had a really big impact on the country and our world. Who flies models? Armstrong flew model airplanes, competed in our national championships. Burt Rutan, who was involved in the X project, who created the Voyager, that was the first aircraft to fly out in space outside of military or government project. You might have heard of Matt Keenan, who works with NASA JPL on a helicopter that flew on Mars. Matt Keenan and his staff are all AMA members. He learned most of what he used in that program. He'll tell you a lot of that. He reaches back to AMA and says, learning flying model airplanes at a young age taught him how to do things that moved him along to design and build and operate the helicopter that's being flown on Mars. The same thing is true with Burt Rutan, Neil Armstrong. There are many others out there that have utilized model aircraft in their careers. And even in today's world, we're reaching out the new ones, and you've heard of different organizations out there, Google, Amazon, possibly delivering packages. A lot of our folks that have been involved in model aviation have been pulled into those organizations to help them develop those ideas and concepts and how to move those things forward. So that's kind of a brief picture. There's members from all walks of life, and so that's who we are and who can be involved. It's just like I said, just about anybody can fly model aircraft at some point or another. So let's move on to the next slide. We worked with the EPA. I started working with them years ago, and my predecessor was involved. We had a memorandum of understanding that we worked together with, and through that, we've been dealing with a lot of things together to collaborate and figure out how we can utilize some of these Superfund sites. These sites have been just a perfect place for airplanes to fly, and the clubs will develop the sites or use or manage the sites for use. Typically, our sites are it could be anything from 5 acres, 200 acres, and with the help of the EPA, we're able to look down the listing that they have of Superfund sites that are out there, and they're some research for us and find sites that have a fit for model airplane activity. Model clubs use a lot of infrastructure. We typically just need a lot of open space. So it's a very minimalistic amount of work that has to get involved, just a lot of open space, maybe a lot of grass to cut. But it turns into a very nice green space that can be used in, as you said before, Alexa, groups that have used the site together, multi-use site is fine for us too. The collaboration that the EPA has provided to give us the expertise of where the fields are, where we actually should take place of our runways and our facilities should be installed and used is fantastic. And as she also mentioned, getting involved early with that process has helped those clubs to develop a site that some of these sites are just phenomenal, just very nice open sites and great places for our clubs to have events where they bring with the local community involved. We have schools and Boy Scouts and different groups that come in and we do training sessions with them, and utilizing these sites is just a real good way for clubs to develop a site that they can hold on to for a good number of years. One of the issues that we typically can have is sites that change hands a lot. We use farmland, and sometimes a farmer passes and the family wants to do something else with the land, and so the site might not be available to that club. So getting a site like an EPA site that can be obtained for a long number of years, typically with a landowner, they're happy to do that, is just ideal for model airplane use. So we can go on to the next slide. Here's an example of one, Kent County Aero Modelers in Delaware. This site is on 8 acres of land, and you can see from this aerial view that the space that the modelers are using is a big area, but that little black area there in the middle is the runway where they've set up to fly the models at. So the models are overflying the area out in front of that. And it's just green space, grass, and possibly there might be some farmland that's being cultivated. That's what it looks like there. And so they worked with the EPA to get the location of where that site should be, exactly what part of the land they should put the runway on. You can see a little bit of detail, but there's that gray horizontal piece with the white caps on the ends. That's just a little shade area that the modelers can set up and put together their aircraft, and a little parking area around the trees, the road in. So it's a very minimal amount of impact to the local environment, but it creates a place where these aircraft can be flown safely using safety programs that have been developed over the years. Here again, we work with the FAA, and we have safety programs that have been approved by the FAA, and they recommend that that anyone that flies model aircraft get involved through one of our clubs as an AMA chartered club and utilize these sites. So another big focus of this is that we reach out to a lot of youth, and we're growing in that area now. We've just finished the World Championships that was hosted up here in Muncie just this past week, where we had 13 countries flying in RC pylon racing. So having these events that are national and even international can encourage young folks to get involved in modeling. And generally in today's world, you'll see a lot of motion with the bigger companies like Grumman, just lost my train of thought. But anyway, any of the major companies, General Electric, Boeing, those folks are hiring people that have model airplane background because they want those folks to have hands-on experience to move forward. So they're reaching out to our youth and to those parents and letting them know that if your child is interested in something in the aerospace industry, this would be a great place for you to get started and move forward. And they'll direct you on some of the different schools they'd like you to go to. So having this in your town or in your community is a great building block for youth to move into an aerospace environment, an aerospace job, whether it's as a pilot, as an engineer, and maintenance, service and design. There's just no end to what you can do in this world. And as many of you might have seen, that American Airlines is struggling to find pilots in these days. A lot of those pilots come from our model aviation group. So having one of these fields in your area is excellent. And it's something that is a positive for the community. Our clubs have raised well over $10 million in the past 20 years for different kinds of charities. So they're involved in the local community as well. So I think I've covered most of it there. I don't want to take too much time. Is there one more slide? I don't remember if that was the last one. Yes. So that's our organization. I'm the safety technical director, and I'd be glad to give you any more information. And our flying site assistance coordinator, Alona Main, is also available to give you more information about what we do. And here again, the reuse of an EPA Superfund site, I think, just makes a lot of sense in the recreational environment that we have today for that land to be utilized again and become a positive impact on your community is just an amazing thing to do. So with that, Alexis, I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you, Tony. And thank you so much. I thank you so much for highlighting all the STEM opportunities for young people as well. I think that is just something that, I don't know, just yet another benefit that maybe people are not used to thinking about in their mind with this, but that's really exciting. So thanks so much for joining us and sharing that. And again, folks, if you are involved in a Superfund site, and you know, we do encourage you to reach out to the AMA. And I saw that there are some questions for Tony already in the question and answer. So, you know, we're really excited about that and highlighting that example of reuse. And before we get to the question part, I wanted to just highlight a couple more tools for folks. So if we go to the next slide, and I might, okay. And so just on this slide, you'll see a couple of images, but you know, just a really very brief snapshot of some of the resources and tools that the Superfund redevelopment has. And we're really lucky to have them, and we really hope that people take advantage of them. That nothing gives us more excitement than that. And so, and you have, you know, in every region of the country, you have really passionate people on the EPA side about this, and you know, please reach out to them. But really, just to highlight for you all quickly, we talked about, and I saw that there was a question about kind of reuse planning. So that is one of the resources that we provide, and that is done through your Superfund redevelopment coordinator and headquarters, and its technical assistance around, you know, reuse assessments, reuse planning, community engagement. It's tailored to whatever the needs are of the site and folks that are working on the site. And it's at no cost to the local community. There are a number of guidances, handbooks, fact sheets on all kinds of topics and, you know, business cases for reuse. You know, you have your stats. We're working on updating a stat that talks about some of the reuse on kind of ecological and ecosystem services. So we're really lucky that we have the opportunity to also kind of highlight the impact of this. And we hope that you can also use that information to kind of make a case at the local level. We also have, you know, when Tony mentioned that Superfund sites often change hands like anything else. And so we have, you know, of course, when you're thinking about buying a Superfund site, there are different considerations that you might need to take into account. And so again, we offer, you know, kind of very tailored discussions and engagement with prospective purchasers of Superfund sites to think about, you know, what are the things that they might want to consider in terms of liability in particular. Also in that same vein, providing comfort or status letters, which is kind of like a quick, these Superfund documents are very long. And they, you know, they get created kind of over the course of years. And so a lot of times during a property sale transaction or something, you want to have something that's a little bit more concise and clear and kind of hits the high points of, you know, what was done at the site and what's the current status. And so EPA is able to provide those as well. And so I think, you know, agreements with of different kinds of models of agreements that you can kind of take a look at and customize for your needs. And so if you have questions about this, again, maybe to go to the next slide, I think that's where they are, is, oh, I'm sorry, before we get to that, there is, well, this will be part of the first step is looking at, you know, finding out more about your site or the site that's near you yourself. And so we've developed this Superfund redevelopment mapper, which is, we hope it's pretty easy to use, web-based tool. You can see it on a laptop here, but you can use it on your phone, which is kind of cool because if you're out in the field, and you can identify, you know, what Superfund sites are in the area, some of the key history of the site and links to some of the more extensive documents, but also give you kind of a snapshot of some of the high points of the site. And then also you can overlay map layers of especially important for thinking about reuse is, you know, key infrastructure like highways, like power line. People are increasingly thinking about using these for solar energy development. And so what are some of the infrastructure pieces that need to be in place for that? And so we invite you, I think we'll probably put a link in the question and answer. Maybe we can do that at some point so people can check that out. And then the next resource to highlight with the next slide are the people. And these are amazing people. I mentioned that I was new to the program, and I got to tell you, you all are in very good hands with all of these individuals listed here and from different parts of the country. So, you know, they are very happy to hear from you, to brainstorm with you, to connect you to these resources. So please reach out. They have so many good stories, so many lessons learned, so much passion and dedication to this work. And so I thank them. Because they, you know, they make this job really fun, and they're fun to talk to. Each person is fun to talk to, so that's another vouch for them. And yeah, please feel free to reach out to all these folks. And let's see what the next slide is. Okay, and feel free to reach out to me and to my colleague Chelsea, who you haven't heard from her today, but she's here and she's standing by and happy to help. We really both are, and we're both based in headquarters, but, you know, so if you don't know who to reach, or you have a question again about working with AMA or otherwise, kind of maybe more of one of the national organizations that you might see listed on our website under partners, feel free to reach out, because we're really happy to hear from you. And thank you again for spending time with us this afternoon. So with that, I think I'll turn it over to Josie for questions.
Thank you. Great. Thanks, Alexis. Let me just show the last screen here. And I also wanted to quickly drop into the chat a link that you can use to receive more information about webinars, trainings, conferences, tools, and other updates. So please go ahead and go to that form and fill in your information, and you'll receive updates about events just like this. So thanks again to everyone for participating today. Tony, I think we're going to start with some questions for you. So first things first, do AMA projects need a flat place for the development? So would something like a landfill, which, you know, is often a hill, would that work? What are the specs?
Yeah, we have all kinds of different models, from helicopters that can, you know, take off vertically, so they don't have to have much of a flat area, just a small space. A lot of drone racing is going on. You might have seen that on TV with the drone racers with the stuff flying around, going through the little gates and stuff. So that's real popular. But actually, my club in Pensacola, Florida, was a Superfund site, and that site was a landfill. And when they renovated, did all the remediation, and it wasn't covered properly. So they did a lot of work, and they, working with those, the folks on site, we got in there early and talked to them about what we wanted, and they created that level area for us. Even though it might not have started that way, it kind of ended up that way. So, and most of the areas don't have to be huge. Like I said, most of the places where you saw on that one slide, the runway area is fairly small. It might be, you know, 600 or 800 feet long and 100 feet wide or 50 feet wide. And then they have some fairly flat grass around it. So yes, a nice flat area probably fits more environments or more different types or more models. But there are lots of groups that fly all types of different models. And so we can make that work with just about anything.
Great. To follow up on that question, Tony, can drones be flown on these sites? Do those count?
Yes. And what we use the term drones, we're usually talking about the multi-rotor helicopter type things that have the four rotors around the ends. And that's what you see in the drone racing. But there's lots of variations of those. The drone racers are fairly small and they're quick and they're a lot of fun to watch, a lot of fun to fly. But then there's larger ones that you can take video with. They'll have cameras on them. Maybe several of the folks here on the seminar today might have one of those. And here again, you don't need a lot of space, a level space to take it off and fly it around. So there's a lot of opportunities there to do a lot of different things. And in today's world of, here again, talking about careers, there's a lot of people that started with a drone and they're taking pictures and now they're working with a real estate agent and they're taking real estate agent pictures for them. Or they might work for a roofing company and these roofers are tired of climbing up on a roof and wondering if it's going to fall in on them. So they now fly a drone around and they do a roof inspection and they can give you a quote that way. So, you know, there's a lot of places where this can move into a career for someone that's interested.
Great. I have another question for you, Tony, about like the size of the site. So is there a minimum requirement for an AMA facility for a site in terms of acreage?
No, there really isn't. Here again, we have some small models. We have a section or a modeling group called Park Pilot. And those folks are flying on something generally the size of a football field. And that's the entire space that they fly in the air. So they may actually have a takeoff and landing area that might be 50 feet square. And that's all they need to take off. And they're flying little styrofoam models. They're very aerobatic and can do all kinds of cool stuff, but they're electric. They're real quiet. You can have them in the middle of a park or, you know, we fly indoors in basketball gyms. I have one little model I can fly in my living room. So you don't have to have a lot of space. And that's what's cool about it, because if there's an environment or if there's a piece of a Superfund site that fits in that area, and maybe it's a section of a Superfund site that's the multi-use, just like you talked about, and it's a section there. The nice thing about it is you can work with a local model club and they can do all the management of running that site. If you just make it available to them, they can use their expertise to bring in youth and do that sort of thing.
Great. Thank you, Tony. Let's kick some questions over to Alexis now. Alexis, we had a question about community involvement, wondering how EPA solicits meaningful input from the community when it comes to reuse and redevelopment. Can you touch on that?
Sure. And I would say, even kind of just more broadly, I think I saw the question that you're talking about in the chat, and it mentioned, you know, kind of some of the final documents around remediation, and remediation is kind of a separate process than redevelopment. Even though we like redevelopment to be considered during the process, there is an extensive regulation really that requires, it kind of sets up a process for Superfund cleanups, and it's called the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Acts of CERCLA. And in there, mandated is a really extensive community involvement program. And so, you know, that's, we feel really good about that. And, you know, coming from other parts of EPA that do not have necessarily that regulation kind of backup, it's really amazing to have, and you see kind of the level of standard of community engagement that happens as a result of that. In terms of redevelopment, I mean, that's definitely one of the things that we offer in terms of our technical assistance. Again, these are decisions that happen at the local level. EPA has kind of the authority to prescribe what happens with the cleanup, but redevelopment is something that's very local. And so that's a combination of decisions from local stakeholders. And what we do try to do, and the reason that we do this work to promote the program so much, is that we do hope that redevelopment will happen with meaningful input from the community. You know, we have a standard of what that means to us. And so we hope that if you're able to use our resources, that of community involvement can happen in a way that kind of meets that standard. And, you know, there are some, if you look on our website, there are different kinds of guides. There is some guidance on meaningful participation kind of in general. And I think that's also being reworked because we can always do better. And it's a really high priority for EPA overall. So I hope that answers the question. Let me know if not.
Thanks, Alexis.
Sure.
So there was another question asking about some specifics on one of your examples during the case study discussion. Yeah. Could you let participants know generally where they can find more specific information about Superfund sites and those case studies in particular?
Sure. And I think that went a bit about the landfill site. But yeah, we have this is one of the, you know, for good reason, one of the most well-documented programs, I think, that we have available. And so there's a lot of information online on each individual Superfund site. And so you can go and, you know, I always start with Google, honestly, even as it, just because it will get you right to where you want to go, and look up any given Superfund site, and it will break down kind of the history of the site, what the cleanup process, what the decision process has been, what the cleanup that, you know, it depends on what stage that particular site is in, but, you know, what's been decided on, what the process for doing that remediation is, if there is reuse or redevelopment that's happened on a given site, looking on that. So yeah, there's, and I wanted to actually make one correction to something that I mentioned with the Lexington County landfill site. I had kind of highlighted that Lexington County was the leading the cleanup of that. That's actually because it was a county landfill. And so they had been identified as the responsible party. And so very happy they did it either way, or happy that cleanup happens. But I just wanted to make sure that I cleared that up. But yeah, please. It's amazing the amount of information that's available online. So, and if you have trouble finding anything that you're looking for, again, please feel free to reach out. And I know throughout our website, not just for redevelopment program, but also Superfund writ large, there's, you know, ways to contact people and try to be really responsive there. So
great. So we have another question in the Q&A asking about incentives to redeveloping Superfund sites. What are the incentives at a local level? Is there anything related to taxes? Is anything about that you could share?
I think, again, that's kind of a case-by-case basis that happens at the local level. So there's nothing, I mean, EPA does not require anything. We actually, speaking of the resources on our website, we have sections and we've kind of reorganized our website by the role that a person might be coming to it. So if you look on our website, you might say, I'm a local government person and I am looking for resources from that perspective. And then you can kind of find that. But yeah, again, EPA doesn't really, you know, it's local development is local, land use planning is local. So we're not able to get involved in that, but we do. I think we might have done a webinar on this at some point, but if not, there are certainly resources targeted at kind of some of that, at least just highlight examples of things that have happened.
Great. And I think your answer sort of covers some of these other questions too. Wondering if we have a training on comfort letters specifically for local officials.
That's a good question. I think that we have some colleagues that are working on that now. We're developing a poster presentation for the Brownfields Conference, but maybe we could take the information of that person and get back to them or put something in the follow-up, because I do think, I don't know that we've had a training on it outside of EPA, but I need to check on that.
Okay.
Well,
yeah, great. If that person who submitted that question, they submitted it anonymously, if they'd like to resubmit it with their contact information, then we can be sure to follow up with them. It's one of the downsides of submitting those anonymous questions is that we can't follow up with the individuals. Another question here, wanting to discuss the potential for future use fact sheets that are available on the EPA website, wondering if any of them contain the property owner contact information, those specific fact sheets.
What if you could speak to that? I would guess that if it's not in there as a standard template, it's probably to protect, you know, privacy of the owners. And just as, you know, Tony and I both mentioned, the property owners can change hands quite a bit. And so I think that, you know, just in terms of preserving EPA resources and taxpayer dollars, we want to create things that are going to last at least for a little bit. So I don't think there would be, but I do think, again, if you reach out to either us or the Superfund redevelopment coordinator in your region, that they would be able to kind of help you track down some of that information. Because they'd be happy to do that. So.
Great. Well, Alexis, I think we've gone through all of the questions actually that we have in the queue. Folks, feel free to submit any other questions that you might have either based on the presentation or our follow-up discussion. Alexis, not sure if you want to give folks the option to raise their hands if they have a question they want to ask over the phone line, or if we just want to keep taking text questions.
Either's fine at this point. I think we have a few more minutes. Happy to hear from you. So, and I see that Josie put in, the chat about being able to submit your interest in more information. I did do a quick, my own Google search on the comfort letters training. I don't know that we have an external training on comfort letters, but if there is interest, and I'm hearing a couple things about local government and comfort letters. So maybe that's part of the really helpful thing about being able to have this like live engagement with you all, is really understanding what people are interested in. So definitely noting that. Some more questions. Oh, great. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I think, let me know, Josie, if there's anything else coming through that you'd like us to.
Not seeing anything else at the moment for us to address. Thanks for pointing out that I put those links into the chat. Please do follow that link to that form.office.com link there. That will take you to a form you can fill in to include your information, including your name, your contact information, your affiliation, and what sort of information that you would like to receive from the Superfund Redevelopment Program. And that will result in you getting not too many, don't worry, emails about upcoming trainings and tools that may be released, keep you on the cutting edge of what's going on with the Superfund Redevelopment Program. And then I also included a link to the Superfund Redevelopment Mapper tool that was mentioned on a previous slide. So feel free to submit any other questions that you might have into the chat. I did see a shout out for, yes, more training for local officials would be great. Noted. Thank you for submitting that feedback. Feel free to submit any comments as well. We do appreciate feedback. Gene, in a little bit, will explain a way that you can also submit feedback via a form, not to steal her thunder there. But yes, please submit any other questions you might have into the question and answer panel. Maybe we'll give it another minute or two to see if there's any last questions that folks may have. And then if not, then we'll pass it over to Jean to do our closing out here.
And I'll just take a second to thank Tony again. Thank you so much for sharing that. I hope you get a lot of follow-up out of this. I think this is...
Well, a lot of folks, as you said, might not be very familiar with the Model Aviations and what it really is. You know, you bought the little balsa wood airplanes at, you know, at the corner store at one point. And this has changed a lot over time. But I did really want to mention that about the Ingenuity and the JPL labs. You might have seen that on the news or in your newspaper about the helicopter that flew on Mars. And they just won the Collier Trophy with the National Aeronautic Association for, and that's a major award that really only happens once a year. And that group won that for, it's kind of interesting, you know, it was 100 years ago or so that we first flew at Kitty Hawk. And now we've got a radio control helicopter flying on another planet. It's kind of hard to believe to some extent. So, you know, it's just really something. So, we're just proud to be part of that, a small part of that.
That's cool. Well, we're proud to be a small part of your small part of that, because that's a really important thing. And yeah, thank you so much for bringing it.
And we appreciate the support and the help that EPA has given us. We've got a lot of clubs that are still involved. They're still working. We're working with your SCIO and other groups, and we just continue to move that forward. And we don't see an end in sight, and we just believe that there'll be more and more sites that'll be out there that we'll work with our clubs and with you folks.
Thank you. Thanks, Josie.
Yeah, I think we might have maybe one more question talking about asking when redevelopment is part of a site, say it's just one of several operable units that make a part of a larger site, does that create complications for either the site redevelopment or the site cleanup? How does that work if it's just a section of the site?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's probably an attempt to make a very already complicated situation more less complicated, because, you know, again, some of these sites are really huge and they might already have a number of different owners. And so it's an attempt by EPA, especially when you're thinking about the construction of remedies, and they, you know, they can take a really long time to kind of design what the remedy is and make sure that you get the right fit. And put it, and there, it's not the same everywhere in terms of the different parts of the site. You saw, like, you know, as the sites were contaminated in different styles across one site, there, you know, everything, it's very tailored, everything. So, yes and no, I think it's already pretty complicated. So, hopefully, it makes it easier. And I don't even think redevelopment happens at one operable unit at a time. It might even be at a, you know, a property parcel level. So yes and yes, super complicated, but good and worth doing.
Great. Well, I'm not seeing any more coming through so far, Alexis. I'll leave it to you to decide when to draw the line and pass it back over to Jean.
Oh yeah, that's fine. Yeah, go ahead and thank you.
Great. Thank you, everyone, for submitting your questions, and appreciate your participation. I'll pass it back to Jean now. All right. Thank you very much, Josie. Let me go ahead and take over that screen share, and I will walk the audience through just a few final reminders before we close things out today. So the first thing I want to do is thank each and every one of you for joining us in today's live session, and encourage you to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network or cluin.org. You'll see some icons there where you can sign up for our free podcasts, other upcoming internet seminars, RSS feeds, and our free monthly newsletter that I send out on the first of each month, which will highlight resources related to hazardous waste site cleanup and characterization. And specifically, I will highlight opportunities for free internet seminars like today's session in that newsletter. So if you're not subscribing to TechDirect, now is a great time to go ahead and do that. The other thing I wanted to point people out, if you were not here at the very beginning, remember all of the presentation materials have been posted on the seminar homepage. So that URL shown here in red has tabs along the top where you can learn more about our presenters, download copies of the presentation material, and access links related to our topic today. It also includes a link to our feedback form for today's session. So if you happen to be replaying the recorded version, you can still go to the URL shown here in red on that screen and fill out the feedback form and access the materials. Now, while I do not issue CEUs or PDHs for our sessions, I can provide you with a participation certificate. And for a number of individuals, that certificate, along with a copy of the materials, a copy of your registration email, is oftentimes enough to document your attendance for credit with your own accrediting institution. If you'd like one of those participation certificates, please fill out the feedback form. And when you do that, do two things. Make sure your email address is correctly listed. And then at the very bottom of the feedback form, please be sure to check the box certifying you either watched the entire live delivery or you replayed the entire delivery. Then as soon as you submit that feedback form, you'll have a link that'll pop up on the screen where you can download the certificate, and we'll also email a copy to you. Sometimes the emails get flagged as junk or spam, so you might want to download it right from that confirmation screen after you submit your feedback. The other thing is, if you shared the line with multiple people at your location, please just simply give them a link to that seminar feedback form, and each person can fill out the feedback form to get their own certificate of participation, even if they didn't register individually. So for those of you who did host a viewing party at your location, please share that link with the attendees that joined you. And then if you happen to be one of the lucky ones who are replaying the recorded version of today's webinar, and yes, I talk about this at the end of every webinar because you want to be sure you watch the entire thing. Right around now, there will be a button above my head in the recorded version of the webinar that has a direct link to that feedback form. But of course, you can also simply visit the URL shown here on red, fill that form out, check the box at the bottom, noting you replayed the whole thing, and you can still get a participation certificate based on your replay of the session. Please know I read each and every one of the submissions that go into that form. So I really do appreciate those of you who take time to give us your thoughts on what we can do to improve and carry on with these free online sessions. With that, I'll just remind everybody that the recording should be posted in about 1 week from our session today. You will automatically get an email when that archive is available. And I encourage you to share it with other colleagues who you think will find it a valuable expenditure of your time, or share it with family and friends. Tony, I don't know if you are going to do a viewing party at home when this archive is available, but we really do appreciate those of you who are able to share these resources with others. And with that, I want to thank all of our speakers, all of our organizers, and all of our support staff on who helped make today's session possible, along with the over 120 individuals who joined us live for our session today. I'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you so very much for joining us.